You're listening to Talking Boat Stuff, the Waterways Podcast, where we celebrate everything in, on, and around the water. This episode was recorded live at the 2024 Toronto International Boat Show and is powered by America's Boating Channel. Now, here's your favorite captain of conversation, Stephen Bull.
Episode 3 that we recorded, and Mr. Bob Azumi, thank you for joining us.
Stephen, it's a pleasure to be here. I mean, how good is it, other than going fishing, to be around this many boats?
Right? Oh, it's fantastic, right? I look forward to it. It's part of that, you know, you need this hit of boating in summer in the middle of winter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't want to age or date you, but this is not your first Toronto boat show. When's your first one?
I walked in here a few minutes ago and I was running a little tight, so I, you know, got in the show, and it brought back a lot of memories because when I was around 20, 2021 was the first year I ever did this. Not 2021, but when I was 20 or 21 years old. 65 now, so you do the math. That was the first time I did any work as a professional angler, and that's the year I turned full-time. So this is, I mean, my 44th or 45th year now of doing this for a living. And Mercury Marine hired me to do seminars at this exact boat show way back when, 44 or 45 years ago. So it brings back memories when I walk through that door, and this is my only little token appearance. After we're done this podcast, I'm going to the indoor lake, and we're going to be taking some folks out before the show closes for some test drives in that new Avator electric outboard. And then I'm out of here and the show closes. So this is a real down and dirty, you know, here for the last quarter or last third of the day, I guess.
So I like that. So all I got to do is put in 40 to 45 years of boat shows, and then I can show up and do just the test drive day.
Well,
I like it.
That first year I got into the business, I was down here doing about 5 seminars a day. Plus, I was looking after a fishing booth on the other side of the show that was owned by Brunswick, too, as well. So I was the only guy looking after the booth. So I remember a guy with electronics company, Peter Stickley, and I can't remember, but it's not even a brand that's around anymore. That's how long ago it was. But he was, Cytex, he was beside me. And I said, Peter, make sure nobody steals any of this. I got to run clear across the show to do another seminar. And I was doing that 5 seminars a day, plus the only person looking after the booth. And that was my introduction. And I got paid $25 a day from Mercury and $25 a day from the fishing company to do that show. But I didn't realize expenses were a little bit costly in Toronto. And even then, I got some hotel on Lakeshore for $60 a night. So I was in the hole every day. I didn't negotiate for expenses. I should have. But that was my first kick at the cat up. First gig in the fishing business full time. And here I am over 4 decades later, still pounding away and doing promotional work and working for about a dozen companies. So it's been a pretty good run.
Yeah, no kidding. And, yeah. You know, you're Canada's most recognized angler. When I've talked to people about who's on the podcast and everything, and, you know, got some fantastic guests that agreed. So thank you. We got Ron McLean coming, Alan Cross. People are super excited. And I've heard, oh, my God, I watched him when I was a kid, right, or I learned how to do this, or I saw him at a tournament. So what's that like for you all these years later to be,
well,
you know, known?
It's funny. Like, I only talked to one other person since I've been at the show here. When I got here, I went to get my media badge, and I said my name to the lady, and there's a guy with his family waiting to get some will call tickets, and he goes, Bob, and he was all excited, and he said, I watched you growing up as a kid, and same thing, you know, it happens every week, pretty much every time I'm out somewhere in a boat. It's nice that, I guess, you make an impression, but the intent, Stephen, was never to have notoriety. That's the weird thing about it. When I started doing seminars and appearances and working for a bunch of companies doing promotional work, in that early, like 1980, in that early era, I was living off what I could make to fish tournaments. And so I was fishing tournaments, making some money there, making a few dollars doing promotional work, and I was starving to death, but I did it for 3 years full-time. And then in 83, we started the TV series, the Real Fishing Show. Not knowing anything about TV, but I'd met a guy at a family picnic that was a distant relative of my sister's, and we hit it off, and he owned a little one-man ad agency in Guelph, and we talked about advertising and TV production. He said, well, I've got a cameraman in Toronto. Shoots rock videos like Joe Cocker and all these famous musicians. He's always in New York and all over the world. I can get him, and why don't we go try shooting something? So we met the following week at his house, talked till 5 in the morning. I got up after a few hours sleep, went off to the tournament. As I was passing through Guelph, we had this meeting. I slept on his couch that night, and the next thing you know, that's how the Real Fishing Show was born. We decided that night we'll give it a shot. And he was always a guy that shot commercials for car dealers, some of those corny ones where the guy's jogging and jewelry stores, things like that. So he was a small agency, but he did know video production in those early years, and then so did, of course, the professional cameraman that we hired, Ted. So,
The origin story of the Real Fishing
Show. Yeah, that's
the
short version, and the rest was a roller coaster ride until we figured out how this business works. And then after 38 years of doing that in 2021, decided to just go fish more tournaments and still keep working, and that's what I'm doing now. So we did the show for 38 years. Radio show for 30 some odd years, magazine for 30 some odd years, and it's been a good run.
Yeah, and you're doing the social media stuff, so you're not done doing the public stuff, but just dialed it back a little bit.
Not really retired, but just to the point where I can do what I want to do more so, but still working. But the whole idea of the TV show, I never even thought of the notoriety and, you know, people coming up to me even to this day saying, I watched your show, or are you still doing the show, whatever. It's more of, I did it to support my tournament fishing addiction. I'm addicted to competitive tournament fishing. There's a lot of them that come here to the Toronto Boat Show because, they like tournaments, and there's bass boats here at the show and stuff. So that's what really made me think that maybe a TV show would be good. When I met my original partner, Bob McGuigan, at that picnic, and then we met in Guelph at his house that night, that's really where, you know, I was thinking maybe a TV show to supplement my promotional work. I had no idea it would do what it did in terms of recognizability or notoriety, whatever. It wasn't something I even thought of, and it wasn't something I was really wanting. It was just something that happened because I just wanted to fish more tournaments and not starve doing them, because there were times when I'd win enough money to go on to the next event and get a hotel, but then there were times when I didn't have enough money and I'd be sleeping in the back of my car with my bass boat behind me in a parking lot at the tournament. And that was, you know, in those early years before I started the TV show. So TV show eventually was a good thing to help supplement my tournament addiction, and it worked pretty well, you know?
Well, that leads right into a question that I had about tournaments, because a lot of people don't know, like, you know, many of us that are amateur at best anglers, you know, there might be a little fun tournament at your marina or something, but the professional competitive tournaments with the cash prizes are a whole different thing. Like, I went to the Bassmaster Classic last year, and that's, you know, wild. But what I didn't realize, what you're saying, like, people sleep in their trucks. It's like the PGA, where you think, okay, well, these people are competing for, like, Bassmaster Classic, $300,000. That's only for one person who wins, and if you don't win, you don't get paid. So people, even though they've got all this gear, might be sleeping in their trucks. So, like, there's a lot of pressure at these tournaments.
A lot of pressure. There's, you know, a lot of big name pros that fish bass tournaments that have made very good livings at it. There's a lot of young up and coming pros that will eventually make some decent money that are still starving, but they have the goods to do well over the long run. You have to realize that there's the competitive field there is so good. Just like PGA tournaments where, you know, a guy might be in the top 10 one week, and the next week he's, you know, some other state or country playing in a tournament, and he's, you know, 100th place. It's the same in bass tournaments. That can happen. So it's like a roller coaster ride in winnings and in losses. And, it's a tough grind starting out. It's not easy. You know, I've won over seven figures fishing tournaments, and I've always said, if you want to win a small fortune fishing bass tournament, start with a big one, because it's an expensive sport, you know, with the electronics, the boats, the equipment, and the entry fees. Like, these entry fees for tournaments are anywhere from small ones here in Ontario, like you can fish terms that are $100, $200 entry fees. You can fish some here that are $1,000 plus entry fees. And then as soon as you go stateside, there's a lot of tournaments that are, you know, $3,000 and $4,000 for the entry fee. And that's just to enter it. Now you got all your hotel, gas, food, launches, equipment, all the expenses.
Yeah, it's a unique way. It's, you've got to really be into it and have a decent shot to make that effort worthwhile, I would think.
You've got
to
be hungry. And I was hungry in those early years, and I had a lot of success, 80s, 90s, early 2000s. And there hasn't been a decade in six decades since the 70s when my dad ran the first bass tournament ever in Canada. He organized it, and that's what got me going as a teenager. There hasn't been a decade I haven't won some tournament so far in six decades now. So it's pretty cool. It's right from the 70s, late 70s, 80s, and right on through till this day. So if I can get into the 2030s and win another tournament, that'll be seven decades. So I got to just got to get, you know, out there maybe exercising or moving around or cut the desserts out so I can live that long so I can do it.
Oh, you got that. Yeah. That'll be, that's a heck of a run there.
You know what? It's what I love to do. It's in my blood, competitive fishing. But, you know, the bucket list got finished. When I traveled the world doing the Real Fishing TV series, we did just a hair under 1,000 episodes all over the world, you know, from Russia to Australia to the Amazon to Tasmania, Spain, all over, including every corner of Canada and the United States. And in the bucket list, you know, as an angler, oh, you want to catch this species, you want to fish this place, you want to try your hand at this type of fishing, whatever. I got a chance to do all of that during those 38 years of producing the TV show. But now that I'm where I'm at in this new chapter of my life the last 2 years, and it was really weird. I surprised everybody about 6 months before COVID or so when I came home one day and I said to my wife and saw my son, Darren, I said, I think I want to wrap the show up. And they were all involved in the production too. And they said, really? I said, yeah, you know all that running around, like we'd just drive up to Northwest Ontario. And we were working with tourism, Ontario Tourism at the time, and we'd get our show done sometimes, like in the first day we were there after driving in a day and a half, 22 hours to get there, get the show shot. That night before we hit the sack, we'd have a little meeting and say, hey, what do we need for the show? Well, we got to get some cutaways to the lodge, got to get an interview with the owner or the manager or whatever. Then we're done. I said, yeah, because we don't need any more fish. We got enough fish the first day, yeah. Okay, let's get that done and hit the road. Even though we were booked for there for 3 days or 3.5 days, it was just to the point where we were wanting to get the job done. And to me, I'm not a victim. Don't feel sorry for me if you're listening to this. I'm just saying that it was a job. I treated every shoot like the last one wasn't good enough. I wanted to get the best shoot every time, the biggest fish, the most fish, whatever. But you can only fit so much in a half-hour show, which is with commercial breaks out, I think it's like 22.50 or something like that or whatever. It's not a lot of minutes of footage. So usually when I got it done, I didn't want to lollygag around and just kick back and fun fish at the lodge. I wanted to get back to go to the next tournament so I could go there and pre-fish, scout the lake or river or whatever, and be ready for that event that might be like 5 days out. And, you know, I was still a day and a half from home, but if I got back early, I'd have a couple days to pre-fish instead of no days. So as I went through all of that over the years of fishing a lot of tournaments throughout every year of still doing all the TV and the appearances, and the conservation work and contests and magazine, radio, all those things, tournament fishing was still always what I thought about always. And now I get to think about it a lot more in conjunction with promotional work I'm doing. So, you know, sitting here with you now, Stephen, is so much easier than it was during those 38 years, because I was on the road about 300 days a year most years doing all that and only home one day a week about on average.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great job. It was a fun job, but it's still a job. Like, people see the finished product and like, wow, that looks wonderful. I'm like, there was a lot of work and travel that went into this, and I know it, but I don't even have to deal, like, you have the extra layer of the fish having to cooperate.
Yeah, but, you know, you doing a TV series, and, you know, you're not a big production company. You don't have 20 people surrounding you doing everything. You know, you're doing a lot. Producing, hosting, directing, whatever, right? the elements that go in to doing it with cutaways and in some mood type shots, and now, you know, with drones and all these things that people expect to see in a lot of TV shows, it's a lot of work, because every little element, there might be like a handful of cutaways, just short clips that you see in the show. People don't realize that took 2 hours to get that darn shot where the boat's running by perfectly framed, right? Or
whatever. Yeah, and it's a 3-second shot in the final thing, but you've spent all day getting three of those, and you're almost at 10 seconds of
content. Well, then the other thing was when we did the TV fishing show, now you got these friggin' fish, pardon my French here, but those fish have to cooperate. The weather has to cooperate. If it's pouring rain, you still got to get the show shot, or if it's windy. And so you need Mother Nature to help you a little bit. And so it was always like fishing a tournament, getting the shows shot. For me, I took it as hardcore as I could when I was there, just going at it hard, like I was in a tournament. You know, let's get the most fish, the biggest fish, whatever. But yeah. Anyway, it was
fun.
Okay,
well, I got a question about a tournament one, and this is maybe it's a political one. We saw it in the news. If you're not those guys that were stuffing the fish and right. all that and weighting it, is that like an anomaly? Is that something that happens? Is that on the tournament, like people are doing that sort of thing? Because that was, to me, like a movie.
If it did, I didn't see it. I mean, there has been very few instances in more professional grade tournaments, there's so many tournament trails out there, both in Canada and the United States. There are so many tournaments out there that very few times have I heard of any cheating in them, because they're pretty governed, you know, and the folks that fish them are paying entry fees and that, and they're pretty serious about it. That was pretty serious stuff with those two guys in Ohio did at that walleye tournament on Lake Erie. And I don't think it was their first rodeo. It looked like they had done it before. Obviously they were, not bad anglers, because they could catch the fish. But then they were putting lead and stuff in them. And it was a bad deal. It made worldwide news. It was the single biggest thing I have seen for media attention in the fishing world in my 40-some-odd years. It was on everything from, headline news to New York Times. It was everywhere, that thing.
Yeah, like late night shows are joking about it. And
right.
stuff. Yeah, it was the thing. And
These guys were putting pliers and lead and whatever they could find down the fish's throat. And see, you got to realize, too, in these walleye tournaments, some of them, you don't have to weigh the fish in alive. Every tournament I fish in bass fishing, it's all catch and release. You have to weigh them in alive. If you weigh a dead fish in, you get penalized to 0.5 pound or 4 ounces or 8 ounces, right?
Okay.
Off your weight for each
right.
dead fish. So the advantage is keep them in the live well, healthy, alive, lots of oxygen, lots of circulation, maybe a little bit of ice, and keep them alive, keep them healthy so you can release them again. And we catch the same fish a lot. Over the years, I mean, sometimes the university in Kingston, for instance, tags a fish, and it'll get re-caught 2 and 3 times in different tournaments, brought in, they take a note of the number and go, oh, that fish was weighed in last year, a month from this tournament at another event, so it's pretty cool. So in that walleye tournament where those dudes got caught cheating, was catch and kill. You can weigh in dead fish.
Oh.
Because Lake Erie's a fish factory. You know, they commercial fish it on the Canadian side for walleyes in Ontario. And it has millions of walleyes. And so all these guys that are catching them in that tournament are keeping them still, and they're going to eat them after. We're in a bass tournament. That's almost like, oh, that's just a no-no. Not many bass tournament guys eat bass. It's just like almost like, not cool,
Right. All right. Well, speaking of tournaments, let's go back to the beginning, before your tournaments, before the pros. Tell me about your dad.
Well, see, growing up in Blenheim, little small town, southwestern Ontario, what happened was my mom and dad separated when I was a year and a half old. I was the youngest of 4 kids, Georgie, Lynn, 2 sisters, and then my brother Wayne, who's 9 years older. So Wayne was the oldest. I was the youngest. He would have been, I guess, 10 and a half at the time, and I was not a 1 and a half. And my mom and dad moved down to southwestern Ontario, where I was born, my sister was born, The two oldest were born Wayne Lynn in Toronto. They moved down southwestern Ontario. My dad got a job at St. Joseph's Hospital in Chatham. He was the head chef there. Plus, he worked every other job you can think of. He worked, he did work in the farms, tomatoes, tobacco, you name it. Just anything he could, plus a full-time job. And all the money he made, he spent it on us four kids and all the neighborhood kids. Taking them bowling, coached youth softball. He took kids fishing, including us. And that's what got us hooked in fishing. When he had free time, that's what he did, is he did stuff with kids. Never drank, never dated any women. He stayed single from when they separated when I was a year and a half old till my early 20s when he passed away of a heart attack. And I was just starting out in the business. He came to one of my first seminars in Barrie, and I had about 450 people, and it was really cool because he got to come to that seminar, but he didn't make it to any of the other things or even, know that I did the TV show because that was after he had passed away. But that was Dad. He was a unique individual. I still run into people in my travels that'll recognize me and say, hey, I'm from your old area, and I used to work in Chatham, and I knew your dad. No, he brought me a steak once when I was in the hospital, and he wasn't supposed to, but anyway, and he kind of broke the rules, and he worked in a Catholic hospital with the nuns, and he was always pulled up on the carpet for doing things he wasn't supposed to, like taking a steak to a patient or whatever, but he loved them all, and I remember one of his best friends was a nun, Sister Mary James, and she was like a mother to us. We'd always go into the hospital kitchen and hospital to say hi to her, once every few months when we were little kids. And I think if she wasn't a nun and Dad was dating, I think they would have been a match now that I look back. They really loved each other. Yeah. They really loved each other as people. And she was such a sweetheart. And then I remember she moved to London and that. But growing up, it was weird. We didn't have any money, really. Dad didn't, when he died, he had nothing. There was no big estate or anything. It was all gone to us and the kids in the neighborhood. But he had a couple wishes. One was stay together when he was, having his health issues. He said, I want you guys to stay together. And he also had pushed me, not pushed me, but brought me up to Toronto, to Mississauga, actually, to Mercury Marine, to get my first interview with Mercury, with Bob Patterson, who was the marketing manager there for many decades. And we went out for lunch with Bob, and we had heard they were looking for somebody to do seminars at this exact boat show around 80 or 81. And it was kind of cool because that's when he said, okay, let's try it. And that was a breakthrough for me. They tried getting Al Lindner, who did the In Fisherman TV series, magazine, and that. Now they're doing Angling Edge, the Lindner family still out of Minnesota. They tried to get Al, who was Mercury-sponsored, out of Minnesota, but he was booked a year in advance and couldn't come. And so it was opportunity, hearing about it, timing, I guess, and then making the move to have a meeting with Bob Patterson. And that started me in the business. And then here I am talking to you over four decades later at this same show, and I can see a Merc over there, and the booth, I think, is right over there.
Yeah, it's all about... Say, I also got my start in 81 in that I was born then. So that's... There's our connection.
Okay, I was going to put you a lot younger than that. So you are old.
It's my youth. Good looks. It's because I'm not trying to catch the fish,
right?
So there's less stress on my
TV all that
show.
Time on the water. That time on the water doesn't age you. It enhances you. Right?
Let's talk about the Canadian fishing scene for a minute here. Jeff Gustafson, Gussie, winning the Bassmaster
you
Classic.
You were there?
Not when he won, the year before. Okay. And it was... Who was the best Canadian that year? I think it was Corey Johnson, was fifth or sixth.
Yep.
Something
and then
like that.
Chris, his brother, would have been there in it.
Yeah,
yep.
And they were in there. And yeah, so Corey finishing fifth or sixth at the time was, the best a Canadian had finished. And then the following year, Gussie wins it all, the first Canadian to ever win.
Right.
These people, I haven't interviewed them. I am confident that they would list off of the people that inspired them that you're on there. So to see where it's gone, and it's like it's not just dominated by the Americans anymore as a Canadian, what are you seeing, and what does that make you feel?
Well, there's the two brothers, Chris and Corey Johnston, up the Peterborough area. You got Jeff Gustafson, who goes by Gussie, up in northwestern Ontario, lives outside of Kenora. Then you got Cooper Gallant, who's just east of Toronto here out Oshawa way, Bowmanville area. So four of those guys that are fishing professionally in the States at the highest level, the Elite Bassmaster Series, I talk to all of them. Every month I'm talking to one or two of them every month. They call me when they're on the road, check in, give me a report on the tournaments and stuff. And I keep pretty close contact with those guys because I knew Lynn Johnson, who's the father of the Johnson boys. So I fished against him in the 80s and 90s. And that, so I know their father very well. So I've been in the business longer than they've been on the earth. And the cool thing is they're excelling at a sport that is so competitive and so tight. It would be like taking, the top 40 PGA and LIV golfers in the world, putting them all together and saying who's the best. And yeah, everybody has their turn at doing well, but they're all phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
These guys are in there.
Have you seen, there's a movie with Matt Damon and Ed Norton from, I don't know, I think it's the 90s, Rounders. It's about poker. Yeah. Anyway, so the only point of this sidebar is Matt Damon is a law student. He's obsessed with, he used to play underground poker and gamble and all that kind of stuff, and now he's trying to be on the straight and narrow. And his girlfriend gets upset with him wanting to play poker and make money, and she says, it's all luck. And he goes, if it was luck, then why do the same four guys always end up at the last table at the World Series of poker? And I feel that way a little bit about fishing. There's people that aren't good at it that think, well, it's just luck whether or not a fish bites your hook. But if it were luck, then the Johnson brothers showing up in the Bassmaster, like as you're saying, the Elite Series regularly wouldn't happen. Gussie, Cooper, for them to consistently show up, make the cuts, it's, as you said, so competitive, and every tournament counts. You can't fail out of most of them and still show up to the big games.
Well, here's the deal with these really great anglers is they have learned through trial and error with spending vast amounts of time on the water. So they're incredibly in tune with different types of conditions, wind, no wind, sunny, depth, shallow, deep, all those characteristics you need to know about to think like a fish. These guys are in tune with it because they are out there all the time. They're fishaholics, you know, they're out there. The other thing is they've got the competitive type A personality that makes them great anglers. And then you put all of those attributes together, and what have you got? You got individuals that can compete at the highest level. And I feel I was there a long time ago, but I still try because I love beating some of these young guys every now and then. It's not near as often as I would like, though. I'm not even going to say how many times I beat them every year, because if I can count them on less than one hand, it's not good. But I know there's usually one or two that I might be ahead of them, you know? Not often, though.
Not often. But they can't say they've won a tournament every decade for the last six decades, though. That's pretty good.
No, and it's been pretty lucrative over the years. You know, won a lot of bass boats and stuff, and a Chevy truck and that. And at one point, I had four Ranger boats during the mid '90s. I had lined up that I had won, but then I ended up selling them off. But that was back when I could win them a little bit easier. Now it's a lot harder.
Yeah. Well, speaking of overtime, we're getting close to the end here, but a couple more questions have intrigued me, and I always love asking people that have been in the industry for a while, changes that they've seen, and in your case, the evolution of the sport. I mean, the obvious one will be technology and outboards and boats and stuff, but are there more people? Is it more competitive? Is there more advertising or money or pressure? So both. Just overall, what have you seen from when you started in 80, 81 to, you know, now in 2024?
Well, first off, it was a little bit more wide open when I started for getting sponsorships and gigs and obviously TV was still a happening thing. There was no Heck, there wasn't even cable, I don't think, when we started. It was just antennas, right? And so, you know, people were forced to see our show on Barrie and Peterborough and Hamilton and all the stations that would get into the Toronto market with maybe 8 or 12 stations at the time total. And that's including the multi-ethnic, you know, the other speaking stations as well. So there weren't a lot of choices. So that helped us. So that would get the viewing numbers up because they're forced to watch us. Now with, you know, the internet and podcasts and YouTube videos and TV networks that are specialized that do just nothing but travel or fishing or hunting or golfing or whatever, the choices are there and people can focus on demand of what they want to see, hear, or do, right, for the most part. And so the changes I'm seeing, a lot of young people, I mean, you know, in their 20s and 30s that I talk to, they like boats, but they're looking at wanting to rent them. And that's why there's some of these big corporations out there that rent boats, you know, that's what they do. And in North America, and Brunswick Corporation has a very successful company that does that, where you can buy, you know, like, you know, time to rent boats. And that, so they want the experience and not as much maybe the ownership in some cases. Now, I'm talking more of the city sort of young ones.
Yeah. So right? Where they like don't have somewhere to store it in a lot of the time. Yeah. So what are you going to do? Gets you out on the water, gives you the freedom. Like, yeah, so Freedom Boat Club, I think, is the Brunswick going one.
Right.
Yeah. So, and you can go other places. So if you go on vacation, I think it's like, you know, like a library card or something like that. You can go here, and I'm going to use this one for a little bit. I'm on vacation. I mean, if you're hardcore into it and going all the time, you know, that might not work for you. But I think it's a great idea for people that want to get out on the water but feel ownership's a barrier.
It is. And you got to realize that there's still thousands of potential customers. Look at this boat show. There's people. I mean, here we are Sunday afternoon. There's still tons of people here. Late afternoon. People love boating, and there's always going to be people buying boats. But I'm just saying, I am seeing a trend of some people that want the experience and want to be on the water, but don't maybe want to own it, but they want to rent it. So I see that, but I also see the rural areas, you know, it's instilled in them to own, you know, ATVs, snowmobiles, boats. You know, they want toys, you know, even if they're 20, 30-year-old, you know, young folks, right?
Yeah.
But I see that. The other thing I see is it's easier to become successful in fishing now. Way easier. If you want to learn how to use forward-facing sonar, which is a big rage in fishing, all you have to do is Google that, and you're going to find hundreds of YouTube videos, and you'll see all the manufacturers' products being used by tournament pros and charter captains and influencers. You'll see them, and manufacturers still have videos out there on how to use that product. Where in the early years, when we were using paper graphs, sonar units that were, you know, just not graphs, but flashers, and then as we started using electronic graphs, it was all a lot of trial and error. You know, there weren't videos out there to watch, unless you watch maybe a TV show or something and you could see it, like we'd do on our show in those episodes. But the thing is, it's easier to learn how to fish now with all of the content that's available. Much easier. You know, could buy some books back in the early years, but there's nothing like watching it in living color on your laptop or TV or cell phone, right?
Well, especially I imagine in the competitive world where, you know, now, yeah, to your point, you can look up all this stuff and get all those edges. But if you're at that competitive level, I don't know, were people sharing the info back then? Like, oh, you have this. How do you use it? Or were people keeping that kind of precious? Like, no, you figure it out yourself. This is my advantage for this one tournament until you figure out this sonar.
We had a lot of secrets early in the early years of the fishing. I mean, when we started flipping and pitching for largemouth bass and we were winning a lot of turns, we'd be mad if we didn't win every largemouth tournament here in Ontario that we fished, my brother Wayne and I, in team tournaments or against each other. We'd be mad if we didn't win because we were competitive, but we had a little, you know, little tricks up our sleeve that weren't common here in Canada yet. A few guys in the States were doing it. We'd learn from them, and then we're applying them here. But now there are not a lot of secrets out there for successful fishing. But, you know, one thing that's a little bit off topic, Stephen, because I know you're going to wrap up soon, but one thing that I wanted to mention is, you know, with COVID, we had a lot of new boaters, right? And I'll give you some example that I saw dozens of times.
Okay.
I'd be in a tournament fishing. Could be Lake Simcoe, could be the St. Lawrence, wherever. I'd watch a boat, $100,000, a $200,000 boat, a $30,000 boat, didn't matter. Cutting across an area that they had no right to be doing on trim, going about 30, 40 mile an hour. They were going over boulders, rock shoals, points. I saw it all in the last, I've seen it my whole career, but I saw it more in COVID when a lot of people were just trying to get out and experience boating or just get outdoors, even if they were, you know, boaters to begin with. But I've seen it my whole career, but I saw it even more so during the COVID period where there's a lot of activity on the water. And what I would recommend to anybody, whether they bass fish like me, but especially just out there boating, if you can have a unit on your boat that's going to show you your depth and all that, any GPS sonar will do that, but have something with mapping on it so you can see where those rock shoals are that are only a foot under the surface.
Yeah, good
because
idea.
That's one of the reasons our insurance premiums are so high nowadays is a lot of people took out lower units by not knowing where they're running in the shallow waters because they were so new to boating. They just see water and think you can go across that bay. They don't realize that there's a shoal they're going through the middle of it a foot under the water.
Oh, yeah.
And then I saw some people freak. All of a sudden it's clearer and they see the shallow and they take it off plane and the boat goes boom, 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 boom and digs in. There yeah. goes their lower unit and their prop.
Oh, yeah. No, it's true. And you know, if you're a brand new boater, there's so many resources beyond, like, so videos for sure start. That's actually not a bad way. If you've never done it, have a look and you'll know what you don't know or learn some things that you should ask. And then you can do lessons and all that kind of stuff.
You could even do it on mapping on your phone.
Yeah.
And see where you are by looking on some of the apps there that'll show you you're on Lake Simcoe or Lake Kuchiching or the Thousand Islands or Georgian Bay. You can see exactly where you are. And if you're running towards a spot that maybe is highlighted in a different color, it could be either deeper or shallower. And if it's shallower, it's going to be an expensive day. And I mean, I'm talking, I saw like, you know, cigarette boats worth hundreds of thousands of dollars roaring over areas that were like a foot deep in rock and sand and stuff.
No, it's wild. All right, well, I appreciate your time. Before you go, I want to put you on the spot. So you've fished, as we talked about, literally all over the world. If you were forced to pick three or five favorite spots or moments, I'll leave it open to you. It can either be an experience, a fish, somewhere you always wanted to get out on the water. What is your personal list? Because we all have our own favorite Bob Izumi episodes. What's Bob's favorite?
Okay, my first want in this chapter of my life in the boating fishing world. I'm not, now that I'm a grandfather, I got two little grandkids, 1 and 2 years old, a boy and a girl. I want to spend time with them. That's obviously aside from what you're asking, but that is up there in the number one spot. But the in terms of this world I live in that I still work in, I would say fish tournaments with a clear head, focus, and not having to think of TV shows to shoot, magazine articles to do, seminars I have to do, radio show, whatever, all the things I had to do during that busy 4 decades of my life. Focus so that I have a better chance of beating some of the young guns that are taking a lot of money away from us older guys. That's number one. Number two is I still have the wish to go to a few places out there. The Amazon for peacock bass, did lots of trips to South America and Brazil and Venezuela. Love it. So that would still be up there in the top 10. Places like Lake Nipigon in Northern Ontario. Uncharted, 4 times the size of Lake Simcoe, full of giant brook trout, walleyes, pike, big lake trout. Spent 3 days there filming and shot like 3 different shows. Never saw 1 boat in 3 full days.
Really?
Yeah. And I don't even like telling that on a microphone because it's definitely on my list to get back there to fun fish. But yeah, there's places I've been that I'd like to get back. But you know, the bucket list got knocked down pretty good. We, you know, did 900 and some odd, just under 1,000 episodes. And we got to pick and choose where we went. And we'd get offers because as long as they would look after, you know, the flights or the lodging and food or whatever when we got to these places, we would consider them. We used to have a stack about a foot high every year of places that approached us that wanted us to come to shoot at their location. So we did a lot of things that the bucket list got knocked down to almost zero, but now I've got a sort of a revamped bucket list.
Oh, I like that. And top of that bucket list, spending time with the grandkids, that's fantastic.
I gotta make sure I live long enough so that I can take them fishing and they remember it. I mean, at one and two, they're not remembering much, but when they get older, and I think somebody told me the other day when they're 4 years old and older, they can retain things, maybe as they become an adult. But boy, every time I spend time with them, I laugh and go, at 1 and 2 years old, they're not going to remember anything we're laughing about today, but I need to get to that point where they do.
Yeah, know? The first few years is that's all for the parents and grandparents. That's our memories, and they don't remember anything. And then when they get a little older, well, they're going to be wondering how come Grandpa has friends at every boat ramp. Everyone comes up to you. What's this about?
Yeah, they're going to go, that's kind of weird. But anyway, so it's fun. You know, it's a different world we're living in. I mean, I FaceTimed my 2-year-old grandson who's in Toronto, and I'm outside of Milton there. I mean, it's so funny to think that he's used to technology at 2 years old, and he's showing me stuff on FaceTime, and we're laughing and stuff back and forth, and I'm like, what a different age we're living in, you know? I mean, FaceTime, when I was a kid, was like we're doing now, face-to-face.
Yep. Yeah. Now, well, you know what? Selfishly, on behalf of the fishing public, I'm glad that you haven't fully retired and you're still doing stuff. But if anyone has earned some fun fishing and tournaments on their own, it's you. So from everyone that watches fishing, thanks for everything you've done for the sport, for conservation, and keep going. Enjoy that time with your grandkids.
Well, I appreciate it, Stephen. Thanks for having me on. And the next time I see you, we'll be hopefully in a boat while we cast for fish, okay?
Absolutely. Let's pick we tried, and it didn't work out, and then it was cold and wet. We're going to do something in the summer. We'll find a good time.
Yeah, don't ask me late November to go out. Even though I'm still fishing, I don't like depending on the weather if you want to shoot a TV show.
Might have to go to Lake Nipigon now, though. That's going to be on my bucket list.
Easy. Don't say that name.
Actually, I think the lake is closed. Sorry, it's no, Izumi's only, I understand, is the rule there. Perfect. Well, have a good rest of your show. Thanks for being a guest here on Talking Boat Stuff, the Waterways Podcast.
Perfect.